energy. So read from Bhagavad Gita chapter 9, text number 10. This is a very famous verse from Bhagavad Gita. Maya jakshena prakriti suyite sacharacharam hetunana nikonteya jagat viparivartite. This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings under its rule. This manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. Very important in understanding this verse, which is one of the, anytime you find a most well-known verses to be memorized from Bhagavad Gita, this verse is always there. It's very important to understand the preceding verses also, because in the preceding verses Lord Krishna explains how this material world comes into being to begin with. And the relationship of the Lord with that act of creation, the relationship of the Lord once the cosmic manifestation is in effect, and how it becomes dissolved and rests within the body of the Lord. This is described in the 9th chapter. Sarva bhutani kaunteya prakritim yanti mamikam kalpakshe punasthani kalpada vishrajam yaham. O son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, of all material manifestations enter into my nature, and at the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I again create. Prakritim swam avashthavya vishrajami punak punak bhutagramam imam kritsnam avasham prakriter vashat. The whole cosmic order is under me. By my will it is created. Under my will it is automatically manifested again and again, and under my will it is annihilated at the end. Of course, when Krishna says by my will, there is more detail than simply that. We find within all scriptures of the world that whatever events take place within this material world, they do so by the will of God. The statement is there within the Vedas. Not even a blade of grass will move without the will of the Lord. The Lord sanctions all things. This notion is directly related to this Maya Jakshena verse, text 10 of chapter 9. That is, that the energy of creation is God's energy, and it is all taking place directly under His will. How this goes on, however, there are various mechanisms by which the Lord can act. Krishna is not having to do anything directly by His will. But by Krishna's will does not mean in some unfathomable mystic way, some indescribable metaphysical way, just beyond any mechanism. The Lord also works with through various agencies, as described, for example, the Pradhan state. This is some technical understanding that I'll explain, but it illustrates the point. Pradhan is the unmanifested condition of the three modes of material nature before the ingredients of material creation take their shape. This is then transformed by the will of the Lord into the Mahatattva state, where there are the elements of, or the ingredients of creation are differentiated, and the modes of material nature are also differentiated, and an expansion of the Lord enters as Mahavishnu. Within various texts of the Vedic literature, this is all described. How the Supreme Lord, Govinda, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Dajami, how Govinda expands into his brother, his form, the form of Balaram, and in turn into the quadruple expansion, Sankarshan, Pradumna, Aniruddha, and Vasudev. These features expand into an Orion feature, and so on. An Orion feature again into another quadruple expansion, and from one of these quadruple expansions, the Mahavishnu, the Purushas come, the Purusha avatars come. And the first of these Purusha avatars is Mahavishnu. He enters into the Mahatattva and lies down in the causal ocean. And there from him, the universes emanate from the pores of his body, his transcendental body. And then again, within each universe, the Lord expands another form, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Within half of the universe, the Lord is occupying the space there. And then again, another expansion of Vishnu enters within every atom. As Shirodakshaya Vishnu. In fact, later in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that he permeates everything, even between the atom. The Lord is there. So in this manner, by the Lord's willing the universe to take its shape, various expansions of the Lord are assisting this will of the Supreme. They're also willing, as the Lord is willing. They're equal expansions of the Lord. However, through their agency, this activity is going on. And then again, by my will, Krishna says, that which is manifest becomes gradually, it returns to an unmanifest state. All the living entities that are captured within the material energy, they are also moving here and there, but also under the spell of the Lord's energy. Krishna is making it very clear and explaining to Arjuna that although all these activities of creation and the maintenance of the universe and the annihilation of the universe, as they are going on, the Supreme Lord Himself remains neutral. Actually, directly, doing nothing. Much like it can be described how a corporate manager of a very, very vast, large corporation, say a manufacturer of automobiles, he is not actually manufacturing the automobiles. He's sitting in an office somewhere, holding meetings and discussing finance matters. As far as the construction, the acquiring, the trucking, the transporting, the unloading, loading, and all the other details of the actual manufacture of the automobile, he's doing nothing. But various personalities within the corporation are deputed various authority and funds and other resources, and they are carrying out what the executive head is deciding, or the board is deciding. But actually they're doing nothing as far as direct manufacturing is concerned. The Transcendental Lord is actually doing none of these things that are just described as far as the act of creation, maintenance, and annihilation. He is existing transcendentally. This is not to be understood, however, that the Lord has no activity. This is part of the sublime philosophy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and of the Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. But actually Krishna has only one thing to do, and that is perform activities for his own enjoyment. This very tiny portion of the whole of the spiritual sky, one tiny corner, is covered by this Mahatattva. And it comes into being and it is annihilated. And again coming into being and again annihilated. But this is not at all the main activity of Lord Krishna. His activity is simply pleasure pastimes, lila, enjoying with the transcendental associates of the spiritual world. Much in the same way, the activities of the God-conscious person or Krishna-conscious person can be described. For the Lord, there is no duty. In fact, in relation to this material world, he is doing nothing at all. However, Krishna describes so many activities he performs simply to set the proper example, because if he were not to provide the proper example, the whole world would go to hell, because they would follow his example. So exemplary acts must be set. This is, however, a statement of the dealings with the external energy. As far as the elevated devotee of the Lord is concerned, he is simply engaged in loving activities in relation to Krishna. All of the associates of the spiritual world can be described in this way. They are simply engaged in loving activities in relation to the Supreme Lord. Externally, in terms of this material world, so many activities are going on, but that is not their real identity. This is being described in a slightly different manner in this connection also. In the contemporary presentation of science, you won't find it in modern high school textbooks that all varieties of species of life come into being at once. But this is the understanding of the Vedic text. The host of beings display their forms after the period of annihilation is over, and again creation is ready to begin. The desires of the living entity come into play, and according to their desire and according to their previous activity or karma, immediately the Lord provides the bodies for them to continue just where they left off. This means not just some lower forms of life at the time of creation again come into play, and gradually forms of life evolve. The Vedic literature gives us this very clear understanding that all the various species of life come into play at once. The Vedic knowledge stands in direct opposition to the presentation of modern science, the evolutionary theory of modern science. The host of beings come into play at once. It must be like that. If one understands the eternality of the soul, if these simple laws of karma and reincarnation, it's a very obvious fact that must be there. As the living entities which are wound up within the body of the Lord for the period from the prior devastation until the next creation, when they come again into some form of activity at the time of creation, as the Lord glances over the Mahatattva, and again the living entities are impregnated within the Mahatattva, and the activity of the soul begins in contact with matter, they're carrying the same consciousness that they left off with, just very the description is given, just like after you've been sleeping at night, when you wake up in the morning, according to your previous activity, you will again remember, oh, my identity is so-and-so. I have to go off to work and be there at such and such time. I'm in a hurry. I must not be late. Or whatever your activities were from the previous daytime. The period of night sleeping has interrupted that only for a short period of time. Whatever your dreams were during that night time, there they come to a close. And again, those very same activities that you were doing the previous day, they will resume. Because of your quality and work, guna karma vibhagashaha, Krishna describes. So in that same way, although the bodies have been temporarily annihilated or put aside during a period of devastation and rest, the desire of the soul remains the same. And according to that desire, then a body is awarded according to that desire. A body is given to us according to our desire and according to our deserve. So that remains the same. Therefore, all the varieties of living entities must come into play at once, because all the varieties were there before the devastation. When this notion of karma and reincarnation become very clear, then the understanding of evolutionary theory cannot stand. Srila Prabhupada is very keen on addressing this misconception. And the whole range of misconceptions of modern science that many people have simply grown up with and become accustomed to. It's very interesting to note the statistics of how many people right here in good old USA accept reincarnation, and how many accept the principle of karma. And yet, in a very inconsistent manner, these very same people accept in a very ingrained way the theory of reincarnation, excuse me, the theory of evolution. They are in direct opposition. At least in certain respects. Especially if one thinks that forms of life evolve. You might say that the Vedic literatures give us an understanding of spiritual evolution, meaning that the soul moves from the lower forms of life progressively, gradually, to the next higher stage of life, next higher form of life. The example that Srila Prabhupada gives in this connection is that just like in the city of New York, there's so many varieties of apartments that are already there. When you move from one income bracket to another income bracket, it's not that somebody has to run out and create a new dollar value on it for an apartment and then you can go live there. But they're already there. Suppose you can now afford an apartment for $600 a month or $400 a month, and then your income changes and you can all of a sudden afford an apartment for $750 a month. That apartment is already there, and so many of them right here in New York. Not very many $400 apartments, but a lot of $750 apartments. So you can then just move your things from this apartment to that apartment, and it's already there. Similarly, Prabhupada explains, the forms of life are already there. And as the soul qualifies for a different type of body, then they move from this body to that body. Suppose then your income changes from being able to afford that $750 apartment till you can only afford a boarding house. become bankrupt or something, and you have to go on welfare, and then you can, then they'll tell you, you must get out of this $750 apartment. And then you have to go to another one. They even have this little children's rhyme about describing some person with very funny features. When they thought they were offering ears, they thought they said something else, so they asked for that kind. And then they thought they were offering noses, and they were offering noses, and they thought they were offering something else, so they asked for that kind, and they ended up with these really funny features. Prabhupada describes like this also. The whole variety of senses are available already. Just like the apartments are available already, all the different features of body within this human form of life and all species of life are already available. The three modes of material nature, they're already working very perfectly under the Lord's direction. And as the living entity is desiring, and as the living entity has deserved according to the previous activity, they will get that body to match those desires, and they're available immediately. They're already there. All species of life are already there from the very outset of creation. And yet the transcendental soul, because just as the Lord is transcendental, also the soul is transcendental, being part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. So the soul has nothing to do with this body and the material nature in a similar manner. However, when a living entity thinks that I do have something to do with this material nature, in fact, when that soul becomes so covered over and bewildered that they think I am this material nature, then they have so many duties that they must perform, so many obligations and responsibilities. And if one behaves and performs activities in this world not acknowledging those responsibilities, then they become severely punished by the laws of nature. Whatever facility they may have been given, that is withdrawn. Whatever asset or resource they may be endowed with, that is taken away by the laws of material nature. Down to the point where they can be reduced to practically the microbial germ as far as the body that one is endowed with or one is given by the laws of nature. But in transcendental consciousness, or practically speaking for everyone sitting within this room, everyone, any spirit soul who has the inclination to understand higher spiritual knowledge, that is a great opportunity, because it means that even one may perform so many duties in this world, actually they are not your duty. One's real duty is to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is the transcendental position. Then, because of my obligation, because of my eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I can fulfill so many activities in terms of this energy of the Lord as part of my duty for Him. One's obligation then becomes to the Personality of Godhead. In so many ways, one can serve the Personality of Godhead very directly. Just as you see our pujaris, when you come here on Sundays, or any time you may come to visit our temple, they're making so many offerings to the deities. That act of offering one's foodstuff to God, that you can perform directly for Krishna. Or go downstairs and see the devotees rolling the puris that you're be eating later on after they're offered to Krishna, and cooking prasad and with the devotees who are cleaning and so on. All these activities you're also doing, cooking and cleaning and eating. and working. But these activities are being performed in the consciousness that they're there for Krishna. This is the training, the platform of devotional service. It must be accompanied with the proper understanding that the Lord is the controller. He is the creator, He is the proprietor, He is the enjoyer. It is not, in other words, it is not some sentimental thing only. The challenge is there for the scientists that this idea of God as the creator, this is just your belief, this is your sentimentality. We say quite the contrary. To accept that unfounded statement, the evolutionary theoretical statement, is just their faith, their belief, and their sentimentality. What logic is there in it? What proof is there behind it? They give some, as Prabhupada called it, post-dated check. In the future, we will prove it. We're making the statement now. Actually, we have no real evidence. But we will have the evidence. This is actually what Darwin did, as many of you may very well know. For how many decades now have it been that people all over the world who are considered educated have gone along with this theory? But what did Darwin actually do? He said, in the future there will be archaeological evidence that will prove my statements. Actually, there is no archaeological record right now, but in the future, I'm very confident, there will be this archaeological record that will prove my statements to be true, that life has evolved from fossils and from algae and from single-cell living entities, the complex living entity of the human form of life. But quite to the contrary, after so many decades, archaeological evidence has proved just the opposite. And yet still people tenaciously hold on, cling to this idea. What is the evidence to substantiate it? None. And now they have a whole other idea. Whoops, it's not in the archaeological record. Now we have to cover our tracks. So now one Harvard professor, he's come up with another idea. And right here in our own New York City, the Museum of Natural Science, the chief personality in collaboration with the Harvard professor, have come up with another idea. Still with no evidence, just some theory, and the world of science is going on in this way. Not just the world of science, however, people in general. And lifestyle is very much influenced by that theory. If life is simply created by chance, that means there is no God and there is no soul. And therefore there is no necessity for morality. Because I'm not responsible for what I do. After all, I'm just a bag of chemicals. And so are you. If my bag of chemicals bumps into your bag of chemicals in some way that enhances my enjoyment and decreases your enjoyment, well, too bad. Because it's the survival of the fittest. Eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you may die, and that's it. It has very wide-sweeping ramifications, this topic. It's not just some, you know, little private feud between the theologians and the scientists. It has very sweeping lifestyle effects. It is atheistic. It is demoniac, actually, in the name of science, in the name of knowledge. And Krishna's declaration are quite the opposite. Mayadhyakshena prakriti sunyatoya sacharacharam hetu nani nikontaya jagat viparivartate. Whether the living entities are moving or non-moving, they are acting under my direction, my supervision. This is knowledge that the devotees of the Lord very, very clearly can understand by dint of their devotion, by dint of their service rendered to God. They can realize this fact. The reality of the controller can be known by the servant of the controller. This is true even in ordinary affairs. So here we are with this new schedule, and RT is going to happen in about 3 minutes. So, does anyone want to raise a question about this? Material bodies, what happens? Death comes. Whether death comes this way or that way or another way. When you say innocent persons, but where is the innocence? Huh? If they were sinless, my point is, if they were sinless, they wouldn't have taken this material birth to begin with. If they are destroyed by some earthquake, you may say innocent, but that's not a fact. To take on this material body means one who is opposed to the will of God. Otherwise we would not take a material body. We would not have received from birth. We would not have been born. We would not need this material body. Can you tell me for certain what the previous lifetime's activities of these whoever might be killed by an earthquake? Why did they take birth there instead of somewhere else? Or, the question that I'm raising is, why did they take birth at all? Because if they were sinless, they would not have taken birth. So you say innocent. But not innocent. They didn't directly provoke the earthquake. That may be a fact. But you don't mean it that way. You mean innocent in that they didn't deserve to be killed. But not innocent. You don't understand. But it's not accident. That's my point. Why is someone killed in an automobile crash? Or a car accident? It's not an accident. And it's not innocence. Why violent death? It's not innocence, not due to, it's not a mistake of God. Whoops. A few people just got smashed by mistake. Yes, due to their karma. Due to their karma, they're taking birth in a particular place. And during that life's duration, at that particular place and particular time, there's an earthquake, and they are killed by that earthquake. That's not accident, and that's not due to innocence. If they were innocent, they wouldn't have taken birth there. And if they were pure in their innocence, they would not have taken birth. Death is certain. Because someone dies, you can extend your argument
and say, simply because someone dies, that's unfair, because of all those someones who die, which is everybody, someone may be innocent. So therefore they shouldn't die? No, because the very fact that they've taken on a material body means not innocent. Innocent of what? Innocent in the absolute sense means 100% in accord with the will of God. That's innocence. Absolute innocence. Such a personality will not take birth. So it's time for Arati to begin. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Oh.